Being the homeless whole again. From treatment for medical, dental, and mental health issues to vocational training to child care and housing placement, Chapman Partnership guides the homeless from hopelessness to self-sufficiency, having served over 90,000 people with a success rate upwards of 62%. You can help the homeless with your support for Chapman Partnership. Details at 877-548-6369 or chapmanpartnership.org.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper with you on this Tuesday afternoon, along with Bonnie Berman. Hello, Bonnie.
And good afternoon.
Well, today we learn about South Florida brownfields. These are sites usually suffering from contamination, which creates blight, threatens neighborhoods and human health. Joining us is environmental attorney Michael Goldstein. He's the founder of Florida Brownfields Association. Welcome to you, Michael Goldstein.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Also in our studio is environmental consultant and engineer Craig Clevenger of EE&G Environmental Services. He has a lot of experience in cleaning up these sites. Welcome to you.
Thank you.
And by phone, we have the director of the Fort Lauderdale Community Redevelopment Agency, Alfred Battle. Welcome to you.
Welcome. Well, thank you very much for having me this afternoon.
Welcome to all of you. Michael Goldstein, give us the lay of the land, so to speak, as far as brownfields for the uninitiated.
Well, South Florida is both blessed and challenged with a broad array of brownfield sites, and we have been for many, many years and many, many decades. We're challenged because these sites present not insignificant risk related to human health and protection of the environment, and also with respect to economic development. But that's where value can be found as well, because they are typically located where people want to be, where businesses want to be, and where people live. And so they present potentially tremendous engines for investment, not disinvestment.
And they're where prior businesses were, such as cleaners of gas stations.
That's exactly right. Typically, industrial operations, industrial businesses, commercial businesses like gas stations, like dry cleaners, like printing presses, like some agricultural operations, they typically leave a legacy of moderate to significant contamination that require a lot of time and effort and care to safely address and reuse.
And Alfred Battle, tell us about the Fort Lauderdale CRA and how it works with the Brownfields projects and about some successful projects that you've undertaken.
We're a agency and a city that is slowly learning to embrace the ability to designate sites for the benefits of the Brownfield Redevelopment Program. Recently, over the last several months, we've done about three or four site-specific brownfield designations for in support of housing projects that have been redeveloped and significantly renovated within the heart of our city. And the developers have been able to capture a significant amount of incentives through the redevelopment program and being able to layer those incentives along with any other incentives that we can offer as a community redevelopment agency has definitely made our brownfield approach here be something that has been successful. The other thing that we've been able to do because of the the negative stigma associated with the term brownfield is we're calling our efforts the job accelerator zones. So anytime that we have an opportunity to designate a site under the brownfield criteria as defined by the statute, we are in turn calling those areas job accelerator zone.
Because so that's some fancy semantics. Or just semantics then.
I don't know how fancy they are, but I definitely would say semantics. But there truly is a stigma in many municipalities as it relates to the term. So we're doing everything that we can to make it be a more comfortable approach from the general development community, because these opportunities may come up in addition to the sites that we've already designated.
And Craig Clevenger of EEG Environmental Services, can you tell us about your experiences and or your experience and the process of cleaning up brownfields site?
Well, the consultant's usually out on the front end. We're working with an investor, developer, and we're identifying these properties. They bring forward a property, and we'll do typically an introductory site assessment. It's phase one, looking at the research of the historic use of the properties, also walk the properties, find out what's going on there, look down on the regulatory records and find out what's known about these properties. And that's where we typically find the historic uses, such as what you talked about, Mr. Cooper, which was the dry cleaners, gas stations, industrial, agricultural sites, old ag sites down in Homestead, for example. These are ideal candidates here because they leave residual contamination, petroleum, solvents, heavy metals in there. And we'll take that to the next step, which is a phase two process where we'll do actual soil and groundwater sampling, evaluate it compared to comparison criteria that are established by the state, and then make recommendations for possible remediation or assist developers in how to overcome the environmental obstacles and still help them facilitate their developments in spite of the contamination. At that stage, typically we're working with somebody like Michael, who's coming in from the legal side here and supporting them to develop the brownfields designation criteria, and someone like Al from a city who's helping facilitate this process in here.
Now, we have federal and state funds being channeled to these projects and also community redevelopment agencies involved. How, Mr. Battle, how about accountability there? It seems like this kind of thing could really be a setup of some financial shenanigans. Hello?
I'm here. I would assume that one could believe that there could be some degree of bait and switch, or the inability for all involved in these types of designations to not be fully aware of all of the review and procedural types of items that one would want to feel comfortable with in terms of approving these designations. But we feel very comfortable in approving what we've been presented with so far, particularly on a site-specific basis. I would say if cities, and many cities have, and many community redevelopment agencies have done this, and that is using the larger designation process to create an avenue for there to be a round of incentives available for sites that would otherwise not be developed or not receive all of the financial benefits available to them in some areas that some would say in the development industry that are very tough to get development capital to do these projects, and into areas that without this type of incentives would be virtually impossible to do, to really close the gap between a successful project financially and one that doesn't get funded or is never to start. So from the financial shenanigans standpoint, I think there's a significant amount of checks and balances.
So there is firm accountability.
I truly believe so. The process is very well outlined by statute, and those in my profession, in terms of the city's review of the various applications that come to us, I think we all do a very good job of making sure all of the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed.
Michael Goldstein, who's actually paying for these cleanups?
Well, that's a great question, and I'm going to answer the question and then take a step back. Without this type of program, without an economic incentive program designed to encourage private sector investment in these challenged and risky sites, the public pays. And that's where this program started, and that's the policy rationale for providing limited incentives from a financial perspective and from a regulatory perspective. Going back 15 or 20 years, what we were seeing across the country was that the federal and state and local environmental laws were having counterintuitive effects at the local level on the ground. And instead of encouraging cleanup and redevelopment, these laws were discouraging cleanup and redevelopment because of the perceived undue time and expense associated with the process. And because there has been so much consumption of open space in urban centers all across the country, there was a sense that focusing incentives in a limited way on impacted sites would encourage smarter and more sustainable growth. And for that reason, the federal government and then state governments across the country and then local governments all across the country created a broad array of financial incentives and regulatory incentives in a very proportional and moderate way to encourage the massive investment of private capital. In fact, EPA recently released a study showing that for every dollar, every federal dollar invested in a brownfield site, $18 and a penny of private sector investment followed. So the private sector continues to carry the significant burden of cleaning these sites up, but with a modest investment from the public sector in terms of tax refunds and tax credits and some regulatory accommodations. And in this way, what we're seeing is smarter, more sustainable growth and accelerated cleanup in communities all across the country in a way that's shepherded also very smartly by local government development officials like Mr. Battle. And the city of Fort Lauderdale has been on the cutting edge statewide. We do work all over the state of Florida, so we see how different communities are responding to this challenge of promoting reuse of risky environmental sites. But the city of Fort Lauderdale has focused in a very smart and thoughtful way to incentivize the private sector to embrace these sites as opposed to run away from them, while at the same time ensuring the proper level of oversight to make sure that the fox isn't let into the hen house.
We're discussing brownfields today on Topical Currents in our studio. Michael Goldstein, he's the founder of Florida Brownfields Association. We also have in our studio Craig Clevenger of EE&G Environmental Services, and by phone, Alfred Battle. He's the director of the Fort Lauderdale CRA. We need to take a short break on our program. Please stay with us, and we'll be right back.
You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN, South Florida's NPR news station. And NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're also available online at WLRN.org. Florida National University is a fully accredited institution awarding associate, baccalaureate, and master's degrees. You can choose from degrees in business, allied health, criminal justice, legal studies, and more. Online day and evening classes are offered. Details at fnu.edu. You can discover inspiration, peace, a new perspective, community, and your divine potential at Unity on the Bay Sunday Celebration Services at 9 a.m. and 11 a.m. There's more information at unityonthebay.org.
Two-time Grammy nominee Seraphic Fire continues their best-selling season with Bach and Monteverdi, The Psalms of David. A critic's top five concert pick of 2012-2013 by the Miami Herald, this breathtaking collection of masterpieces by Bach, Monteverdi, and other greats is what Seraphic Fire does best. Performances November 14 through 18 in Dade, Broward, and Boca Raton. Tickets at 305-285-9060 or seraphicfire.org.
And welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman here with Joseph Cooper. And we're discussing South Florida brownfields today on the program. In our studio is the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm. Oh, from the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm, Michael Goldstein. We also have Craig Clevenger of EE&G Environmental Services. And by phone, Alfred Battle, who's the director of the Fort Lauderdale CRA. Michael, I wanted to ask you a two-part question, actually. Is community approval required to designate a brownfield site or area, and how does one decide which areas are going to be designated?
That's a great question. Absolutely. Community approval is required. There's a very specific process that's set forth in state law, and it's actually the local government, the board of elected officials within the jurisdictional entity, whether it's a city or a county, that ultimately gets to decide whether or not a site or an area is designated a brownfield. And typically what will happen is an environmental lawyer like myself will work very closely with an environmental consultant like Craig Clevenger to determine whether or not a site has sufficient environmental uncertainty and risk associated with it to merit this limited array of limited portfolio of economic and regulatory incentives that can be brought to a redevelopment project to make it successful so that the private sector will embrace it and not run away from it. And in terms of determining specifically whether a particular site meets that criteria, Craig is probably the perfect person to speak to it because he's so experienced and expert in evaluating environmental risk.
Craig?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
Well, the question was, how do you decide which areas are to be designated?
Well, it goes back to the historical use of the property and what might be left behind from that historical use. I would participate in the first brownfield site in Miami-Dade County, and that was working with the city of Miami, and it was an old bulk laundry facility in the Wynwood area. And we went through the full array of the assessment, the phase one, the phase two, expanded site assessment, and identified petroleum hydrocarbons, free floating product in the ground, left over from Bunker C fuel oil, for example, and came up with an innovative approach to leave the contamination in place and still be able to facilitate the development. So leaving contamination, but making it safe for the development, and they were able to develop it into an industrial commercial facility. And that was the first brownfield site in Miami-Dade County.
What is
for
it now?
It's a concrete plant.
Oh, okay.
It's a concrete. But we've worked on, Michael and I have a lot of experience in working on sites that have taken nurseries, taken burrow pits where they've actually done some extensive dumping of not only garbage, but automotive parts and hydrocarbons and solvents. And these sites have successfully been redeveloped into apartment complexes, for example. And they're safe for the public, and they're closed, and they're just is the contamination's left in place.
Mm-hmm. Alfred Battle, how about some of the big projects in Broward that were brownfield?
I wouldn't know about many in Broward. I can only speak to those in Fort Lauderdale.
Okay.
And in Fort Lauderdale, they have resulted so far in terms of our designations into about almost 400. Or taking old housing sites that are been significantly renovated and renovating about 400 units of affordable housing that have been around in our city for over 50 years and using a designation to allow the developers to have enough capital to develop those sites. And just recently, with Michael's help as well, we did another site-specific designation to support a new large, very large restaurant that is going to be moving into our city as well. So we've done it, you know, for some housing and in support of the housing services that are there, but also to support some new retail that's going to have a significant job impact for our city.
What restaurant and where is it?
It is a new Bo Campers Bar and Grill that is up on Oakland Park.
Is this something that investors can kind of speculate with, of trying to pick up these properties that have contamination problems and speculate that they're going to get grants to clean them up?
There is a very healthy market in brownfields reuse for a variety of developers and end users. There are the opportunistic or speculative developers who are involved in various segments of the market, including this one. There are other developers who are more strategic. Lennar is one, is a housing developer.
What does that mean, more strategic?
That looks at developing brownfield sites on a constant basis, not on an ad hoc or on an accidental basis. First and foremost, the decision is, let's go and find these sites because we know they're where we want to be. They're strategically located, and they provide a lot of value to us in terms of the demographics, the ability to achieve our business objectives. We understand the risks and the costs associated with them. We have good consultants like Craig Clevenger. We have phenomenal local government officials like Al Battle in the city of Fort Lauderdale who are willing to help us cross over the threshold from risk to reward. So that's what I mean by strategic. And then there are also institutional users like the city of Hollywood, like other municipalities in Miami-Dade County, like the city of North Miami, that are looking, and now the city of Fort Lauderdale, that are looking at assets they own. Some of them are relatively modest in size, an acre, 2 acres, 3 acres. Others have assets that are much larger, like the city of Hollywood has a old landfill site that's 30 acres. The city of North Miami just got through an RFP process and brought in a tremendous developer on a 170-acre site that's going to, at the end of the day, attract over $1 billion in development.
What's RFP?
I'm sorry, a request for proposal. That speaks to a competitive bidding process that local governments typically enter into in order to convey publicly owned land to get the highest and best use and the best,
and the best
financial offer, best project, right?
Craig Clevenger, tell us about some of the worst sites that you've dealt with as a consultant. What are we looking at? What kind of contaminants and how dangerous?
Well, some of the I guess most challenging sites that I've dealt with old incinerators, and they leave behind residual of heavy metals, polynuclear aromatic hydrocarbons, and dioxins. And those are some of the more challenging from a health perspective. But, see a lot of sites with chlorinated solvents from dry cleaners, typical old gas stations, auto repair that leave home.
They have tanks below ground that are
You often find the tanks still behind. A lot of these sites are in a state-funded cleanup program. So they're basically put on an amnesty list, these old gas stations, where they were half cleaned up, and then the state ran out of money, and they aren't enforced to do cleanup, but the contamination is still there. So you'll see developers come in, and the site's ideal, part of a bigger site or the site itself, and they'll do some type of they'll need to do the cleanup in order to facilitate the development. So you mentioned grants. You don't see a lot of free money, such as grants, provided to the developers out there. There's grants provided by the EPA down to the states and the municipalities to help them vet out these sites and possibly provide a small pool of money to help people get through maybe some additional or some initial assessments. But the big money and the cleanup, it's really the developer and the investors, the people that are buying these property, that are going to put the money out of their pocket. And like Michael said, there's a modest incentive to provide tax incentives on a certain percentage of the site rehabilitation activities that they perform. They'll get back in form of tax credits, and there's job creations.
Well, Craig, I have a question for you. Before I do, let me open this up to our audience. If you would like to join in this conversation about South Florida brownfields, perhaps you live in an area that was a designated brownfield at some point, or you just have questions or comments, the number to call is 1-800-743-9576. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can email radio@wlrn.org. That's radio@wlrn.org. I'm interested to know what environmental agencies oversee the cleanup. Are there environmental agencies that...
Yes. We're talking about the state brownfields program right now.
Yes.
So the Florida Department of Environmental Protection is the ultimate state agency that oversees this. They have delegated their responsibilities down to counties and certain counties, such as Miami-Dade County. The Department of Regulation and Economic Resources, DRER, they're responsible for managing the brownfields. And they have a coordinator here, Sandra Rizzola, and her boss, Wilbur Mayorga. They are basically the regulators and the enforcers of the process as it's brought through from a regulatory perspective. In Broward County, David Van Landingham manages that as a brownfields coordinator for the Economic Protection and Growth Management Department up there.
So they oversee it like at every step of the cleanup or?
Yes. Yeah. So there's a specific guideline that you follow. This is after what we talked about earlier was the phase one, the phase two, where you're getting your hands around it. When it goes and becomes a formal brownfield site, the person responsible for brownfields cleanup is a specific term. They'll sign on, and this will be the owner of the site or possibly the developer. And they accept the responsibility to clean this site to the standard that's they're held to, and that's where the regulators come in, and it's negotiated as far as what that endpoint's going to be. And there's a specific guideline for doing the site assessment, for doing the remediation, possibly some monitoring, and then providing documentation of the closure for it.
Either Mr. Battle or Mr. Goldstein, in the material we have, it talks about brownfields as far as real or, quote, perceived contamination. Can you distinguish between that? What's this perceived business?
Mike, you want to take a stab at that one?
Sure. In the marketplace, many times fear of contamination can be more economically paralyzing than actual contamination that you can get your arms around. So, for example, if we hire Craig Clevenger's firm to go out and perform a historical environmental investigation, and they come back and say, well, this site, Michael, was a landfill, or this site, Michael, was a dry cleaners for 40 years. We're not quite sure what happened there, but we know that it operated in this capacity for decades. Well, we know from many, many decades of experience as environmental lawyers and environmental consultants and real estate professionals and local government professionals that these types of sites typically have significant contamination issues associated with them. And so the mere history of an activity that in the past has caused contamination makes capital skittish, tends to limit the enthusiasm of lenders to provide financing.
So you can have a consultant give you a report then that gives the property a clean bill of health?
Well, the there are various iterations of a report that a consultant will give you. The first phase of the investigation is non-invasive. It's a historical overview combined with a site inspection. And that tells you what you think you might know about the property in terms of what's going on in the subsurface. Ultimately, to document what's actually in the subsurface, if there's actual contamination versus the perception of contamination, you need to conduct an investigation of soil and groundwater and perhaps of other types of environmental media like air and vapor and sediments and surface water. All of that is very expensive. And this is the key point for the whole show, and that's this. Many projects die at other meritorious projects die at that point that Craig comes back and says, hey, you could have a problem here. Because developers and local government officials and lenders know that to figure all of this out and then to address it costs a major amount of money and takes a major amount of time. And who needs the headache, frankly, when you can go on the edge of town and find a green space, not a brown field, but a clean field. But from a public policy perspective, we don't want that. We want development directed towards infill communities because that's where people live, work, and play. It's much more efficient to have that kind of infill development. Al, did you want to add to that?
I just wanted to follow up on the point that you made earlier, Michael, about there being a cost to the community when that happens. Making these types of sites available in inner cities are very valuable to the redevelopment of cities. And when you have sites that don't meet the test initially because there are these found issues that a developer is exploring or has found to be of an issue. Most cases, these sites sit fallow for a variety of reasons, and because there is either a known or perceived contamination issue there, that is a reason why the sites sit still or sit vacant. And from a city development standpoint, a redevelopment standpoint, they're very difficult for us to encourage and attract development interest to if that issue is issue number one when it comes to talking about a site and what opportunities to develop exist if you have this issue of contamination, whether real or perceived, in front of it.
We're speaking about South Florida brownfields on today's Topical Kerns Tuesday edition. Bonnie Berman with Joseph Cooper here. In our studio, we have Michael Goldstein from the Goldstein Environmental Law Firm. He's also a founder of Florida Brownfields Association. Craig Clevenger of EE&G Environmental Services, and Alfred Battle is the director of the Fort Lauderdale CRA. Stay with us. We need to take another short break, and we'll be right back.
Right back to Topical Currents here on South Florida's NPR News Station 91.3 WLRN and NPR for the Florida Keys 91.5 WKWM. Art lovers can gather every third Saturday of the month from 7 to 10 p.m. in downtown Hollywood for Art Walk. You can enjoy fine art, dine with friends, and be part of the revival of downtown Hollywood. More information at gohollywoodfla.org. We're funded by listeners like you and by FPL. More than 10,000 FPL employees are constantly working to make its systems stronger, smarter, cleaner, and more efficient so that Floridians have reliable electric service now and for years to come. More information at FPL.com.
Like Topical Currents Facebook page at facebook.com/topicalcurrents. Join the conversation, post a comment, share links, and see what other listeners are saying at facebook.com/topicalcurrents.
And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Our topic today is brown fields. Joseph Cooper, along with Bonnie Berman, also Michael Goldstein, Craig Clevenger, and Alfred Battle. Let's take a call or two. Once again, the number 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. And Bonnie will take your email. It's radio@WLRN.org. First up, we have Carlos in North Miami Beach. Hello, Carlos.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Good.
I have a question or a comment. I wonder if anybody else has noticed that it seems like every other corner gas station is now becoming a bank. And speaking of what your guest mentioned about properties that sit fallow for years, a lot of these old gas stations seem to just be abandoned, especially along the Biscayne Boulevard corridor, and now all of a sudden they're getting cleaned up, or hopefully cleaned up overnight, and becoming banks. Is this an unintended consequence of the federal bailout of banks? And how is this happening so fast now when all those properties sat abandoned for years?
Well, you know, this is economic policy engineering at its finest, and it has very little to do with bank bailout and everything to do with the proper allocation of economic incentives and regulatory incentives. All along the Biscayne Corridor, there is a tremendous amount of pressure for redevelopment with money coming in from all over the country. It's a very exciting time to be in South Florida for a lot of reasons. That hasn't made the environmental risk go away. It hasn't made the legal liability go away, and it certainly hasn't made the contamination go away. But because there are incentives and there is a very well-understood regulatory process for addressing contaminated sites, especially old gas station sites where the cleanup is not that complicated technically, it just takes time and money, there are more end users who are willing to roll their sleeves up and embrace these sites, acquire them, secure financing, and clean them up. And for that matter, there are more lenders who are willing to finance. And it's not just for banks. We're seeing a tremendous amount of gas station redevelopment.
There's some restaurants that were gas stations.
For, that's right.
Right.
Restaurants and pharmacies, and for that matter, health clinics. There's a phenomenon occurring across the country called Doc in the Box, where you're having urgent health care clinics sited on pocket brownfield sites like gas station sites. And on top of that, we're seeing, and we haven't really touched on this issue yet, this trend in brownfields redevelopment and reuse, but we are seeing a significant amount of redevelopment of these corner gas station sites for public parks and for other types of conservation and recreation amenities in communities.
Now, if a property has a brownfields designation, does that limit the liability of the owner should something down the road occur that the cleanup wasn't quite as effective as they thought?
What kind of
liability do these owners have?
There are two answers to that. There's a legal answer, and then there's a consulting answer. And then
how about the general public answer?
The general public answer is this: the liability isn't any less as a result of the brownfields designation. It just becomes more manageable. It becomes more manageable because there's a more straightforward and expedited cleanup process, and because there are more tools, more technical tools that can be brought to bear to address the contamination. And finally, from a legal perspective, a statutory perspective, the state and the federal government have said, if you are going to roll your sleeves up and embrace these sites, we want to reward you by providing you with actual liability protection. And so there are some legal accommodations that are made to shield a developer and an end user and a bank and a local government from the types of lawsuits that might otherwise be brought. Now, the quid pro quo is that the developer who's coming to the table and taking advantage of those liability accommodations and enhancements agrees to clean the property up. So it's not there's no free ride here. It's the opposite of a free ride. It's an accelerated commitment of resources towards the actual cleanup.
I thought that some of these brownfields didn't have to be contaminated.
That's correct, and that's because many times it's the perception of contamination, the fear that contamination exists. It's that fear that creates the market dysfunction, the marginalization in the marketplace. And you've got these little pockets of disinvestment.
So, Craig, how does one find an environmental consulting firm? I know you have EE&G Environmental Consulting Firm, but if somebody were just, looking for one that didn't know about you, how would they find one?
Well, I think a lot of our business comes from word of mouth. You know, we work closely with attorneys like Michael Goldstein and many other attorneys, environmental and real estate, and work closely with lenders. So a lot of times people are coming into the process, they have legal counsel, they have a relationship with a lender, and they're getting recommendations. Of course, they can always look, the websites, they can always look, phone books, things like that. But most of my business comes from word of mouth because, we're just our reputations here. And so we've built over 20 years, our business in South Florida and all over Florida.
You mentioned there were incentives. What are some of the incentives for these brownfield projects?
For brownfield projects, well, there are various levels of incentives and they come from various levels of government. At the federal level, depending on the type of end user that's involved, it could be a local government, it could be a not-for-profit entity, it could be a private developer, there are grants, there are tax credits and tax refunds. That's at the federal level.
Okay.
At the state level, there is a significant portfolio of major financial incentives that are keyed to the actual costs of cleanup. And so for some cleanups, you can achieve a 50% reimbursement of your cleanup cost for every year that you conduct cleanup. There are other incentives like—
And that's from the state.
From the state. There are tax refunds that are tied to job creation because this is not just an environmental restoration program, it's an economic development program. And so the state wants to reward job creation in these areas by providing specific tax incentives that are key to actual job creation. And then local governments have a basket of resources that are available as well. And Al can speak to what the CRA typically brings to the table to induce private capital investment.
Yes, thanks, Michael. In many cases, projects that are in community redevelopment areas suffer from the inability to have all of the private equity capital and borrowed funds in order to see the project through to having a reasonable return on investment. In many cases in our area, we're assisting projects through direct cash investments by improvements to the infrastructure, such as sidewalk improvements, lighting improvements, landscaping, things of that nature. And probably that's our most common way of helping projects, especially larger projects, invest in CRA types of communities. There are other examples, but the common investment strategy is typically with making infrastructure improvements that not only increase the ability or the visibility of the project in terms of making the entire area looking better, but it also helps the bottom line for the developer. So layering that on top of the brownfield incentives usually makes the those type of investments much more attractive.
We're talking about South Florida brownfields. We're going to take a short break on the program and be back with more.
And you're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. That's South Florida's NPR news station, NPR for the Florida Keys, 91.5 WKWM. We're also online at WLRN.org. It's Harvest Drive's 20th anniversary of Children Helping Children. Harvest Drive provides families a week's groceries plus fixings for Thanksgiving dinner. Drop-off locations throughout Broward County are at harvestdriveflorida.com, brought to you by the Children's Services Council of Broward County.
Sunday Afternoons of Music for Children presents Peter and the Wolf and Friends this Sunday, 3 p.m. at the Frost School of Music at the University of Miami. The cast of characters is portrayed by instruments of the University of Miami's Frost Symphony Orchestra, while Peter's adventures are narrated by Martin Bookspan. And Ronald McDonald is available for a meet and greet this Sunday at Gussman Concert Hall. Tickets at 305-271-7150 or at sundaymusicals.org. Hello, it's Bonnie Berman. Join us for Wednesday's Topical Currents when we address alimony reform in Florida. Our current alimony laws were enacted in the 1950s when few women had career opportunities and a spouse needed financial support. Today, many women make sizable incomes and may be primary breadwinners. Next year's legislature will address the issue. That's Topical Currents Wednesday at 1 o'clock.
Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman, also Michael Goldstein, Craig Clevenger, and Alfred Battle. Let's take a few calls. Next up we have Jamie in Miami. Hi, Jamie.
Hi. Mr. Goldstein mentioned a brownfield property that had a laundry previously and was now operating as a cement maker. I happen to have a property right next to that property with my own contamination problems. There was a battery company previously there, and I have lead. My question is, if the laundry company, now a cement company, didn't have to clean up their contamination, is there some way that I can qualify for that type of a program?
This is Craig Clevenger. Yes, you would, because you're in a designated brownfields area, designated by the Miami-Dade County, and you would have to come forward and agree to be the person responsible for site rehabilitation for your property and execute a brownfield site agreement. So you would designate your site as a brownfield site, and then you would be eligible for the economic and regulatory incentives, similar to what the laundry went through next door.
Which is not to say that you wouldn't have to, you wouldn't be allowed not to conduct any cleanup. It's to the contrary, a cleanup would still be required, but it might be a cleanup of a lesser magnitude. You might not have to spend as much. It might not take as much. The approach that you bring to the table may be a little different, and you would be able to tap into important monetary incentives that could help make the process less expensive. The quid pro quo, though, is that you would be posturing your site for redevelopment. The state is going to want to see that as a result of its investment, its modest investment in your property through tax incentives and tax credits and the like, that you are creating new jobs, that you are attracting additional private capital, that you're creating a higher and better use that puts more money on the tax rolls. That's the essence of the Brownfields program. It's not a get-out-of-jail-free card.
Okay. What would be my first move? Who would I contact to get started?
I guess you need a consultant, right?
Exactly.
That's what it looks like.
And that consultant, which of you gentlemen?
That would be me, Craig Clevenger with the E&G Environmental.
Okay.
I'm sure you can go online and get a host
I'll
of others.
Do that. Also. I will do
yeah,
that.
Yeah, there's plenty of good consultants throughout the area, and I have specific experience with the brownfields, and I can help you. But there's several other qualified consultants out there, so you can find me online, E&G Environmental, Craig Clevenger.
Okay, we have to run, Jamie.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
We have an emailer, and this is from Lindsay. The developer is getting legal protection, but how do we know that they've done the cleanup? How do we know in this day and age of corruption that the site is in fact clean? What protections do the citizens get? Also, where are the contaminants dumped?
Mr. Battle, would you like to address that?
I'll try to address part of it in terms of the first part of the question, in terms of what assurances that do we have that the site is clean. I think Craig and Michael alluded to the fact that the first part of identifying the contamination starts with the preliminary environmental assessment process. and I believe Michael specifically honed in on this point, and that is when a site or an area, and I'll stay with the site part of it because I think that's what the emailer is referring to, is that there is a very prescriptive process as it relates to the site specifically complying with the environmental cleanup procedures as outlined by, in this case, Broward County's Department of Environmental Protection. And if a site does not meet that particular criteria, and Michael or Clerk Craig, correct me if I am incorrect at any point here, that it will not get a clean bill of health. Excuse me there. But there is a process in place to ensure that the property owner does comply with the all of the rules and regulations of the cleanup process as it relates to where the site is, where the contaminants are dumped. I'll let Craig or Michael chime in on that.
Yeah, this is Craig. I want to emphasize again, when you come forward in this program, you're working with regulatory agencies, and so this program has more regulatory oversight than most programs that we work with out there. A lot of times, people go and go under the radar, and so you're in the light, and you've got regulatory oversight and a specific set of criteria for assessment and cleanup. As far as where contaminants go when they're cleaned up, I think they're alluded to when at sites we excavate soils, for example, and we take them off site. They'll go to one of two places. One is an incinerator where they're burned and disposed of there. Another is a lined landfill. And again, all this is under regulatory oversight, so we're providing documentation of manifests of where it goes, the volume, and it's a very tight process here.
If they're incinerated, wouldn't that create something toxic in the environment?
Yeah, it's a different type of process there. But there's regulations on those incinerators.
I see.
Mr. Okay. Battle, how about some public properties that are brownfields designated in Fort Lauderdale?
We have a few that have some environmental designations on them. Whether they're brownfield or not, I'm not specifically aware of the designation as we've been talking about here today. Our process here in the city has really been to facilitate development on a site-specific basis. At this point, we have yet to go into a more a larger area designation, as I think has been talked about in Miami and some other parts of even Broward County, where they have larger areas designated as brownfield areas. We're discussing that internally and may move forward with something to that effect very soon. But you know, we're like many other cities in that we have some sites that are environmentally challenged, but we're dealing with them in different ways, not necessarily through brownfield designation.
Let's squeeze in a phone call. I'm very short on time. We'll go to Kathleen in Boca. She's been waiting a long time. Thanks for your patience. Hi.
Thank you, Mr. Cooper. Great program. Please do have some more. And I'm calling because I'm having a problem in my home with a high level of toxicity. There's an odor of chemical, like a plastic, burnt plastic, and there are also times where, you know, there's a peppery odor and smell, and much of my belongings are destroyed. So I'm calling to find out if I will be able to find out how can I get discovery, and to have a lead of discovery how to battle this problem.
Craig Clevenger, any advice?
Well, definitely. It sounds like you're troubled by this problem, so I would get some consulting advice. Find a good consultant that can do indoor air quality assessment, and they can come in and they can evaluate your issue, whether it could be mold related, maybe something, some gassing from some material your house is built on, or possibly some chemicals or something that you have stored in your house.
Who should she contact, though?
She can actually contact a local regulatory agency if she's concerned, and at least get a start there. And she can also look online for consultants to do indoor air quality.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but I was just going to ask about some brownfield success stories in the area.
Well, we have. It's interesting that you say that. The entire state has had a tremendous amount of success with the brownfields redevelopment. We have over 230,000 acres designated as a brownfield in the state of Florida, with close to, in Miami-Dade County alone, 10,000 acres. We've got some wonderful success stories within the county, including, for example, along Biscayne Boulevard, where an old 10-acre construction and demolition debris landfill site was turned into a $50 million retail project, creating hundreds and hundreds of jobs.
Well, we certainly want to thank you, gentlemen. Michael Goldstein, Craig Clevenger, and Alfred Battle. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Very interesting hour.
Thank you.
And that wraps up today's edition. My apologies to those callers we couldn't get on the air. Our program was produced by Richard Ive, technical direction from Caroline Brader-Watts. Paul Leary is online producer. More information about our program from the Topical Currents Facebook page, including author and book links, discussion, staff photos, and more. Free audio archives and MP3 downloads are yours at our website. That's WLRN.org. Ah, tomorrow's program looks at alimony reform. Florida alimony laws were drawn up during the 1950s, and the Florida Alimony Reform Group says social and economic landscapes justify change. And to our calendar on this day in 1850, 162 years ago, the birth of Robert Louis Stevenson in Edinburgh, Scotland. Kidnapped, Treasure Island, and the strange case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. And on this day in 1975, 37 years ago, the death of Union activist Karen Silkwood under suspicious circumstances outside Crescent, Oklahoma. She was a chemical technician at Kerr McGee and most likely died from plutonium contamination. And one more while we muse on hippopotamus ballerinas. On this day in 1940, 68 years ago, Walt Disney's Fantasia is released in New York City. It was a cartoon version of Goethe's The Sorcerer's Apprentice. Our theme music created by Michael Levine. And we leave with a thought from Robert Louis Stevenson, who died in the Samoan Islands at the age of 44. Quote, "He who knoweth the precepts by heart, but faileth to practice them, is like unto one who lighteth a lamp, and then shutteth his eyes." This is Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. Thanks for making Public Radio your companion today. Stay tuned now for the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is